When and why to fear God, and when and why to fear Satan. I'd like to begin with Satan because I don't want to think about him any more than I have to. And yet there are times that we should think about him. Everything we know about Satan we learn from the Bible. We don't know a single thing about him other than that which is revealed. The Bible reveals the devil as a person. The first messianic prophecy was partly about him. The Lord had a confrontation with him. The devil is just as real as you are. The Bible reveals the devil as a created, personal, malevolent, worldwide power who is the enemy of both God and man. But notice that the devil is a created being. The devil is not deity. We had a good lesson yesterday about the deity of Christ. But the devil is not on a par with Christ. The devil is not eternal. The devil is not a fallen god. The devil can be restrained. In the book of Job, he was allowed to afflict, but he could only go as far as God would permit. He was restrained, thus not omnipotent, thus not God. In the 22nd chapter of the book of Luke, Jesus said to Peter, "Satan has desired you that he may sift you like wheat, but I made supplication for thee that thy faith fail thee not." The devil wanted all of the apostles, but he only got one. He'd have liked to have had them all. He attempted to get them all, but he was unable to accomplish his design. God can do anything that's consistent with his nature and his character, but the devil cannot. He is not equal to and opposite of God. So we ought not to underemphasize the devil. But neither should we overemphasize him. I believe the Bible indicates that Satan may have been a fallen angelic being. However that may be, he's definitely superhuman. Many times brighter than you and I. Many times more powerful. Worldwide in his influence. In Job's day, he was going to and fro in the earth, walking up and down in it. But although he's well organized and has many minions to do his will, and although he's as malevolent and wicked as we can possibly imagine, although he is the adversary and the opponent of God, and the slanderer and accuser of the brethren and of God, and even though we are in an epic spiritual war with him, we are told that we are not ignorant of his devices. And we are told that if we will resist the devil, he will flee from us. Because greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. We have the avenue of prayer. And it has been well said that Satan trembles when he sees the weakest Christian on his knees. So we need to have the devil in a proper focus, and I appreciate this subject. I'll tell you personally and frankly, and you may not look at it this way, but this is the way I look at it. I'm not quite as afraid of the devil as I'm afraid of myself. Yes, the devil tempts. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lusts and enticed. The devil cannot touch me beyond what I allow insofar as sin is concerned, and that's our real concern. I don't care what else the devil can do to me if he can't make me sin. And he can't make me sin. I'm drawn away of my own lust and enticed. Yes, the devil knows how to dangle the bait out there in just the right way. But we're not ignorant of his devices. His devices have been revealed to us. And it's not the tempter without, it's the traitor within that gets me into trouble. That's my primary concern. And that brings us right back to the fear of the Lord. Because if I can get my fear of God right, it'll go a long way toward a right life. What about the fear of God? This morning we talked about persecution. And in that context, the Lord said in Matthew 10:28, "Fear not them which can kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear him which is able to destroy both body and soul in hell." He's talking about fearing God. God's the only one who can do that. The fundamental fact of our existence is our relationship to God as creature to creator. And the basic response our Creator expects from us is fear. Now that may not be the most important response that He wants from us, but that's the basic response that He expects from us, because it is foundational. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, Proverbs 1:7. It's the beginning of wisdom, Proverbs 9:10. The biblical words for fear, Old Testament and New, have two main connotations as seen in the title given by the elders. Respect or terror. Both of these are connotations of the words that are translated fear in the Bible. There is fear in the sense of being afraid of God, and there is fear that comes upon man. This fear of being afraid of God is generally what comes upon man when he has sinned, because it is a fearful, that is a terrifying thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Hebrews 10:31. Given the fact of sin, this fear, meaning terror, is a legitimate fear. The other connotation of fear is the sense of reverence, respect, and deepest awe. In Leviticus chapter 19, verse 13, children are commanded to fear their parents. Is God telling them to be in terror of their parents? No. This is the fear of respect. Although there are times when it would be wise for a child to be in terror of his parents if he has done wrong. 1 Peter 3, verse 2 may be understood as telling wives to fear their husbands. But here again we have the fear of respect rather than terror. In a prophecy in the book of Isaiah, chapter 11, verses 2 and 3, the prediction was made that the Messiah would be filled with the spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. This must not be construed as terror or dread. Jesus was not afraid of his Father, but he did reverence his Father. There are circumstances in life which may change our fear from one sense to another. Let me try to give you an imperfect illustration of this. If I go up to Casey's, walk in, I park my car in the lot, I walk in the store, I make a purchase, I'm walking out of the store, and I run into a police officer. I respect him as an officer of the law. I fear him in that sense. There is some awe there. But I'm not in any hurry to get away from him. I have no reason to be. I may greet him, may hold the door open for him. And then I go on my way to my car. But play that same scenario again. I go and park my car in the lot. I walk in and I rob the cashier in Casey's. And then I'm walking out the door and I encounter that same policeman. I'm going to be in stark terror. I want away from him now. What's changed from one story to the other? The police officer hasn't changed. He probably has no idea yet what I've done. But I have guilty knowledge of what I've done, and I know that he's about to find out, and I want away from him as soon as possible. The thing that changed is me and what I know about myself and my own situation. Conscience is involved there. Paul, in talking about relationships, it was actually Peter, wasn't it? In 1 Peter 2:17, he said, "Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king." I was honoring the king in the first story at Casey's. But Paul, in talking about our relationship to civil government, says, "If thou do that which is evil, be afraid." Good advice. I did that in the second scenario. Why be afraid? "For he beareth not the sword in vain. He is the minister of God, a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil." Romans 13:4. In relation to God, his fearsome and awesome infinity overwhelms us with a sense of awe at the very thought of him. We are overwhelmed with our own smallness and weakness in the presence of the omnipotent and omniscient God. We recognize the infinite distance between us and him. Even angelic beings cover their faces in God's presence and cry out, "Holy, holy, holy." Isaiah 6. No wonder Jeremiah said, "There is none like unto thee, O Lord. Who would not fear thee, O King of the nations? Indeed, it is thy due." Jeremiah 10, verses 6 and 7. The fear of God is the most essential of human attributes and attitudes. It may not be the most important. Jesus teaches us to love God, Matthew 22:37. And he says that this is the first and great commandment. But the fear of the Lord is foundational, the beginning of knowledge and wisdom. Therefore, the most essential of human attitudes. I am not convinced that we'll ever love God as we should unless we fear him as we should. The fear of God is the key to life. This point is made at least three times in the book of Proverbs. 10:27, 14:27, 19:23. Put those together. The fear of God is the key of life. The fear of God is the key to peace and well-being. Ecclesiastes 8:12 says, "It will be well with those who fear God." Proverbs 15:16 says, "Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and turmoil without it." Fear of God is the determinative attitude of the heart. Fear of God is the characteristic mark of God's people. They are God-fearing people. Not so very long ago, it was a compliment to say that somebody was God-fearing. Today, I don't know what that does in people's minds if you say about that about somebody. But in the Bible, it was considered a very good thing. Look at Abraham and Job and Cornelius, God-fearing people. On the other hand, the ungodly are devoid of the fear of the Lord. There is no fear of God before their eyes, Romans 3:18. It would seem, from what you and I know about God and what we know about ourselves, it would seem that reverential fear ought to be the natural response of man to his Creator. It would seem like this should occur automatically without exception. But that's not how the fear of God works in human lives. Therefore, we must be commanded to obey God. And we must teach our children to obey God. Because it does not seem to come automatically. We are told, "Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." Philippians 2:12. And although trembling in that sort of a context does not always mean terror, there are a number of cases where the trembling was not necessarily the result of stark terror, 1 Corinthians 2:3, 2 Corinthians 7:15, Ephesians 6:5 are a few examples of that. However, an awe that is reverential enough to induce trembling seems beyond what is commonly meant by reverential awe. There's a mixture there. Let me ask you this question. Is it possible for a God-fearing person today to be filled only with reverential awe, with never any mixture of terror and dread of God? And my answer to that is probably not, because of the reality of sin. Now, ideally, God does not want us to be terrified of Him. We have lots of admonitions to fear not. But we have this continuing problem with sin. And the Lord's apostle said, even of civil government, if thou do that which is evil, be afraid. How much more where God is concerned? In fact, the Lord's apostle, the same apostle also said in the same book, in fact, just a chapter earlier, behold the goodness and the severity of God. On them which fell, severity. But toward thee, goodness, if. There's always an if. On thee, goodness, if thou continue in His goodness. Otherwise, thou also shall be cut off. Romans 11:22. So we have to look at both sides of this coin. Just like Joseph had to tell the interpretation of the dream to the baker as well as the butler, one must have been fun to tell and the other not fun. We've got to tell both sides of the truth of this story. And the bottom line is that there is this tension in humanity subject to sin. Yes, we love the grace of God, but there is also this continuing problem with sin that will make the grace of God of none effect to us if we don't watch our P's and Q's. God knew what we needed, and this is what He has given us. Consider this. The Apostle John spent years with Jesus Christ. Years living with Him, walking with Him, talking with Him, eating with Him, working with Him. Not only was he an apostle of Christ, but he was in the inner circle with Peter and James. Not only was he in the inner circle, but he was the disciple whom Jesus loved. I don't think there was anybody closer to Jesus than John was among his disciples. But when he turned around on the Isle of Patmos and saw the glorified Christ, John did not say, "Well, how you doing, old buddy? Great to see you." No. What was his response? "When I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead." That was the Lord's apostle's response. And that better be our response. Yes, the Lord touched him and said, "Fear not, here's what I want you to do for me." That's true. But this is the same Lord who said, "Sit in the back, and if they want to honor you, they'll invite you up to the front." Similarly, we'd better have an attitude of prostration that does not presume too much. We ought to be perpetually amazed that the mighty holy God has anything to do with us at all, because we certainly don't deserve it. If we want 2020 vision on the fear of God, we should look at Exodus 20:20. This tells us something we need to know. Because Exodus 20:20 contains the word fear twice in an interesting juxtaposition of ideas. The children of Israel had delighted in God's mercy. They had come up singing out of the Red Sea. They had followed the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud. But now they were called to face God Himself. Beyond all the things that had been between them and God, now they are at the mountain. Behind all the superficialities of their life, they were called to get at the heart of their life. God has pronounced the Ten Commandments with thunder and lightning and trumpeting and smoking. And the people recoiled. They were afraid. And they moved from the foot of the mountain to a place afar off. And they pled with Moses to serve as their mediator, because they feared that God would kill them. Let not God speak with us, lest we die. They hid behind a man to keep away from God. That's where we are when we come to Exodus 20:20. Moses said unto the people, "Fear not, for God is come to prove you, and that his fear may be before your faces, that ye sin not." Fear not, because God is trying to get you to fear him. With two meanings to the word fear in that sentence. This is an attempt to remove one kind of fear and instill another kind. Do not fear with such a fear as brings consternation and produces nothing but terror. Fear with a fear which reverence and affection inspire, but still has enough dread in it that you sin not. God is testing his people here to reveal whether they will obey him. God is seeking to produce people who fear God in such a way that they do not sin. The test revealed in the hearts of the children of Israel a fear that drove them from God. It should have produced a fear that brought them closer to God. An awful fear of God, that is AWEFULL, fear of God, that they might be kept back from sin by his mighty manifestations of power. It included the idea of dread, because the fear of God includes the fear of judgment. But the right fear of God is more extensive than mere dread. It has that awe and reverence and honor and worship which constrains adoration and love. The fear that the test at Sinai should have produced is modeled by Isaiah when he has a rather similar call from God. In the 6th chapter of the book of Isaiah. First, Isaiah says, "Woe is me, for I am undone," in the 5th verse. But then, when the coal is taken from the altar and touched his lips, and he's told, "Now your lips are purged and purified, who will go for me?" Isaiah says, "Here am I, Lord, send me." He's going with God, working with God now. And that's just in the 8th verse, 3 verses later. It's not a fear so as to draw back. It's a fear so as not to sin. Don't let your religion satisfy itself with anything less than God. Don't hide behind 3 songs and a prayer. Don't hide behind any superficialities. Insist on having your soul get at God and hear his voice from his word. Our attitude should be that of Samuel. "Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth." At Sinai, we really have man fearing his native element. Man was made to talk with God. Adam did that before fellowship was broken. The people at Sinai are talking like a fish, saying, "Don't throw me in the water, I might drown." They don't even understand the situation. Don't avoid God, seek God. Did you notice in that chapter, and we didn't read that part, but you know the story. As the people drew back, Moses drew near. Did Moses fear God? Absolutely. So terrible was the sight that Moses said, "I exceedingly fear and quake." He was just as afraid as the people. But the display which drove the people off attracted Moses. Moses even went into the thick darkness. Afraid of God's wrath, Moses drew near to God. Where God was, he would be. "Lord, to whom can we go? Thou hast the words of life." The divine presence is both attractive and repellent. Seems like it depends on the heart. One man said to Jesus, "Lord, I will follow thee whithersoever thou goest." There were also those who came to that same Jesus and besought him that he would depart out of their coasts. They were tired of having him around. Why? Why do we have both of these responses? Because God is love and God is power, and wherever he is, he exhibits both of these qualities. That's why the divine presence at once attracts and repels, at once charms and frightens. The Israelites, invited to draw near to God, declined the offer. Moses, given the same invitation and having witnessed the same sights and sounds, draws nearer. The same manifestations that repelled the people attracted Moses. The demons, who have no love, believe and tremble. You're going to work your salvation out with fear and trembling. The demons also tremble. People who believe in God and have greatly sinned perhaps cannot help seeing God mainly as a consuming fire, which he is. Sinful Adam fled and hid after hearing God's voice in the garden. David said in Psalm 119, verse 120, "My flesh trembles for fear of thee, and I am afraid of thy judgments." When the church beheld the judgment on Ananias and Sapphira from God, great fear, not just fear, great fear came upon them all. Whenever we consider the judgment of God on sin, it's impossible not to tremble with terror if we're thinking straight. But we must not fear only with the fear that has torment. The fear of the Lord is clean. It cleans us up. It tends to repel sin rather than be repelled by God. The mere terror of the Lord is not enough. It drove man from God rather than bringing man to God. And these same people at Mount Sinai who were so in terror of the one true and living God that you might think they would serve him forever, these same people who were so in terror, within 40 days they were dancing around their golden calf. But where love increases, fear changes its character. The dread diminishes, although I don't think it should ever entirely go away. It should always be there, at least in an incipient form, or at least in a potential form, for when we're sinning or when we're considering sinning. For times when we're tempted, that dread needs to be there. But the awe increases as we love the Lord more. Love draws us toward God and rejoices that God allows us to go boldly to the throne of grace. That even though we in Christ are completely forgiven and are not under condemnation, it is at least occasionally appropriate for fear, terror, to strike our hearts at the merest thought of falling or falling away. And there may be times when that will keep us clean. Yes, we need the magnet of heaven before us, but we also need the fire of hell behind us so that we have both of those motivations. A reverence of God's majesty, a dread of his displeasure, an obedient regard to his authority over us. This fear will help us to be circumspect in our walking. So Paul says, don't be conceited, be not high-minded, but fear. The underlying warning of the whole book of Hebrews is, let us therefore fear, lest a promise being left us of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. Hebrews 4, verse 1. Willful apostasy carries with it a certain fearful, that is, terrifying expectation of judgment. Hebrews 10, 27 and 31. Yes, grateful love should now be our primary motivation for serving God. But this will never altogether exclude the fear as an incentive for avoiding sin and doing good. One who stands in awe of God is going to stand in awe of the commandments of God. Terror hates punishment, but reverence hates the evil itself, which leads to the punishment. And I think that's a key difference. Terror hates punishment, but reverence hates evil. Proverbs 8:13 says, "The fear of the Lord is to hate evil. By the fear of the Lord, one keeps away from evil." Proverbs 6:16. So Solomon says the conclusion of this whole matter is to fear God and keep His commandments. This is the whole of man. Ecclesiastes 12:13. We should be perfecting holiness in the fear of the Lord. 2 Corinthians 7, verse 1. We should be conducting ourselves in fear during our time on earth. 1 Peter 1:17. Sometimes I think of us as a lineman working high above the ground at the top of a pole. He's got a line of electricity running by him that has many more times than the amount necessary to kill him. And he has an awe of that. He's working right beside it, maybe all day long. He knows that if he touches it, he dies. So he must pay very close attention every moment. But if he's protected, and if he pays attention, he need not spend all day long shaking in terror. Similarly, we reverence God in awe all of the time, and we should shake in terror when we're considering doing wrong or have done wrong. The fear of God in us is that which reflects our comprehension of who God is and what God is. And who God is and what God is will tolerate nothing less than total commitment to Him. The commandments of God are the concrete expressions to us of God's glory and of God's will. If we're committed to Him in love, we love His commandments too. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. The fear of God and the love of God ultimately are just different aspects of our response to God in the glory of His majesty and holiness. The fear of God is an attitude that must find expression in open praise that doesn't care who knows that we fear God. We acknowledge His greatness, but not only do we acknowledge His greatness, we work to cause others to voluntarily do the same. This is what God-fearing people do. This is how they live their lives. We're going to conclude this afternoon by extending the Lord's invitation once again. There are people here in various degrees of need with regard to salvation and with regard to this subject of the respect and terror of God. You know your own situation if you're looking at your circumstances realistically. We don't know the hearts of those who are present. We want to offer you an opportunity to come out from among them, be separate, to touch not the unclean thing, to make up your mind in repentance that you will serve the Lord who created you and who has bought you back with the blood of Christ. Bill already paid. But you have to reach out and take that free gift. This is serious, a serious invitation for some of you who have never acknowledged Him, never come to Him in simple trusting faith. You should be quivering. You should be nervous about your situation if you are hanging by a thread over hell. You have not the assurance of one more breath, even if you're young. You may not live out the day. That makes life interesting, But it should make life terrifying if you're outside of Jesus Christ. If you've never acknowledged Him before men, never repented of your sins, if you've never been immersed in water to have your sins washed away, there's no good reason for you to leave this building without Jesus Christ living in your heart. We extend you this invitation and opportunity. Please come to the front if we can help you as we stand and sing the number that's been announced.